Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest James Wasserman, who is the author of The Temple of Solomon, From Ancient Israel to Secret Societies. He is also the author of The Templars and the Assassins, and James has created a wonderful book introducing us in a great way to the history of the Old Testament, on through the New Testament, and then on through the Knights Templar, and finally to the Freemasons, to look at some of our very, very, sacred historical traditions involving the Temple of Solomon and all of the different things associated with that. It is certainly a lot easier than reading the Old Testament and the New Testament, and I really enjoyed the book. Thank you for joining us, Jim. Where are you calling from?
Hi, Dr. Kolb. I'm speaking to you from New York. How are you?
Great. Well, I am doing well. I appreciate your joining us today. Would you give our listeners a little bit of background on yourself? I know that you have studied this subject for a long time, and just how is it that you came to write such a fascinating book?
Well, I've been interested in spiritual studies since I was kind of turned on to the Holy Spirit in college, and that was, you know, a very long time ago for me. And I actually left school in 1968, I think, to pursue spiritual studies full-time. And I did a lot of traveling throughout the United States and places to meet different teachers. And I've been involved in, you know, a great deal of reading. I've been a reader my whole life, and I've done a lot of work with an organization called Ordo Templi Orientis, which is fashioned after the Knights Templar. So it considers itself a successor order to the Templars. I mean, not with historical papers or signed charters or any of that stuff. We have all that today, of course, but in our modern incarnation, I guess we've been in existence since 1895. But the mythology of our order goes back to the Templars. So, you know, I studied the Templars in depth, and obviously the Temple of Solomon is the central archetype of the Knights Templars and the central focus of their order. And it's such an important part in the focus of all, you know, secret societies or esoteric organizations or Western occult societies, because it's an essential part of the Bible. You know, it really is, in many ways, I call it the spiritual heart of the Bible in the book, because I felt that it was kind of a midpoint between the unity that's experienced in the very beginning of the Bible in the Garden of Eden, you know, before Adam and Eve were kind of tempted and thrown out of that state of unity, and then the state at the very end of the Bible in the book of Revelation, where it talks about the holy city and the New Jerusalem and that kind of unity that is once again experienced by by the human and divine. And somehow the Temple of Solomon sort of fits in about the middle of that whole process. And it represents a time when the high priest of Israel and the entire nation of Israel was focused on, you know, the presence of the Lord in physical manifestation on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem.
Right, and I've done some reading and some studying that indicate that the Ark of the Covenant, although location unknown now, may be very, very important part of the ascension as well. It may actually be, if you think of what's happening as a great engineering process where we go through a dimensional shift, the Ark of the Covenant may actually be also very important in that, in that the upcoming shift or the shift we're currently in. So it is incredibly important to understand the history of what the Ark of the Covenant contained, what it meant, and of course the Temple of Solomon being where it was stored or where it was, where it was kept.
Absolutely. So, you know that the book focuses on both the temple and the tabernacle in the desert where the ark was first stored. So
right.
My entire focus on the in the book is the ark and mm-hmm. The idea of sacred space. You know, that was the archetype that really took me my interest. The idea mm-hmm. that, you know, we make distinctions between everyday reality and the kind of the magical circle or the formal space of worship that we set up and we imbue with our the energy of our aspiration and you know that becomes so important, whether it's an interior space or the idea of something like an ascension or dimensional shift, it becomes like you're fueling an energy toward a concentrated focus point, and yeah. and that's really important to me.
Well, I have a very odd sacred space, but it was sacred before I built the building. I built I took a building and renovated it. It's about 10,300 square feet and put four operating rooms in it. And the first operating room is called the Diamond Room. And it had it was always there. It had a vortex in it. And I think you probably know what a vortex is. The vortex is most of the great temples are built on vortexes and you know they're along certain ley line areas. I'm sure you're familiar with all of that. But when I go into, I may be feeling a little bit under the weather, but when I go into my operating room, and of course I spend hours and hours and hours in my operating room, I feel better and better and better. And the patients do so well when they are operated there. And I've had surgeons with me who can't operate there. They operate in room 3 because they can't stand it in room 1.
Oh,
and if
that's
you walk
amazing.
Into room 1, you just feel that energy of a temple. It is just beautiful.
That's amazing. You know, I mentioned in the book that I had some problems with the whole concept of the Western Wall or the Wailing Wall.
Uh-huh.
You know, it just to me was not the most important or you know valuable symbol of Judaism. It just seemed to me to be almost celebrating defeat, and
right.
I
felt the same thing at times. That's true.
Yeah, but you know when I went there and actually got against or near the wall, I had mm-hmm. to really re-examine my feeling because there was such an incredible power there, man. Talk about a vortex. I mean, I was
yeah.
stunned. It was the last thing I expect. Sometimes with spiritual experience, the thing that you have to rely on is how absolutely surprised you become, how it does not fit your mental preconceptions. And that element of surprise is really important. And boy, did that happen to me at the Western Wall.
Yeah. Well, it is important, and I think the listeners need to pay attention to this idea of sacred space, that if you have the same intent and reverence and ritual in an area of your house and don't use it for other purposes, then you can build a sacred space. And it's actually an energetic space that others can come in and if they're attuned to it, can energetically feel it. And that's probably an area where prayers are heard more readily. You know, it's might be a little closer to the higher dimensions. You never know.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree. It was certainly the idea of the Holy of Holies and the you know the location of the Ark of the Covenant and the idea. In fact, the Ark itself was some kind of radiating sacred space, in that it held the two tablets of the Ten Commandments. So it the ark itself was an enclosed space, and then it was further held in an additional enclosed space of the Holy of Holies that was part of both the tabernacle and then later the Temple of Solomon.
So one of the things that I didn't know much about before I read your book was that the foundation stone. I didn't realize that that was an important part of the temple.
It was incredible, and I mentioned in the afterword to the book that I was taken into the Dome of the Rock with a film crew, and for a they paid a fortune to get in there, and for a non-Muslim, that is really an unusual experience.
Right.
And, you know, it's another vortex, an unbelievable energy source, and what the archetype or the myth of it is that it literally is the first point of manifestation of the earth. I talk in the book about, you know, the heaven sent forth a ray of light, and that light coalesced into the first point of matter, and that first point of matter became the rock, and from that rock grew the planet Earth. And that rock is still there to this day, and it's said to be, in some of the ancient Jewish writings, it was said to be the location of the Garden of Eden. In the Bible itself, we know that that's where Abraham took Isaac, and of course,
right,
in the you know, in the Quran, that was presumably the site where. Or at least in Islamic tradition, not in the Quran itself, but in Islamic tradition, it's the site where Muhammad made the night journey, where he traveled to what's called in the Quran the Far City, and they say that's Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And he stood on the rock, and they say that you can still see his footprints before he ascended into the heavens riding his winged steed. So it's a pretty powerful rock. And
no kidding.
Yeah, and it was the foundation of the temple. Oddly enough, during the period of the second temple, which lasted even longer, the first temple lasted for about 400 years, and it was built by Solomon. Construction was finished about 957 BC, and it was destroyed in 585 BC. So. Then the site stood empty for 70 years during the period of the Babylonian exile. And during that period, the Persian Empire conquered the Babylonians and gave the Jews permission to go back to Jerusalem and build a second temple. But in that temple, which stood until the time of Christ, actually, it was destroyed in 70 A.D. by the Romans, so about 35 years after the death of Jesus. That temple did not have the Ark of the Covenant, because the Ark was either lost or hidden in 585 B.C. And during that period, the Holy of Holies, the rock was what stood, you know, came up through the floor, and that was the symbol of God to the priest in the Holy of Holies. So yeah, it's a pretty intense rock, my dear.
and the Bible, in the New Testament, it talks about Jesus turning the tables of the money changers over. Was that at this temple as well?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's a really curious story, because until you actually, you know, study the Bible a little bit, it's confusing. It almost sounds like, what were the money changers doing, in, you know, at the temple? But there was a very important reason why they were there. In the book of Deuteronomy, that's called the Book of the Law, you know, written by Moses, the Israelites were commanded to go to the central temple location and to bring a sacrifice. Well,
right.
If you lived in Jerusalem or in the outskirts of Jerusalem, you know, you would literally take some vegetables or some animals that you had raised, and you would sacrifice them at the temple as part of your obligation 3 times a year for these great festivals. And but if you lived, you know, far away, you certainly couldn't travel with that kind of stuff. The produce would wilt if you had slain the animal before. It would rot, or if it would be, it would be very difficult to travel with a live animal. So what they did was they would sell the animal in their hometown and get money, and they would take the money to the temple, and then they would buy a sacrificial animal locally in Jerusalem. But there were so many different currencies running around in Israel at the time in the ancient world, that they would have to exchange the currency for the local Jerusalem currency. So the money changers were the people who did that. And apparently what happened during the time of Jesus, there was a degeneration of the temple ceremony. And apparently what happened by the time of Jesus is there was a lot of corruption, and they would sell these like franchises, and the money changers would make, you know, greater profit than they should have, and it was
they were like cheating the people.
Cheating the people, that's right. And
so that's why Jesus did it. He was mad.
Yeah, and he got mad. And he was right to be angry, but what was interesting is how legitimate the practice of the money changers literally should have been if they had been operating properly, you know?
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, let's talk a little bit about, let's start with the Ark of the Covenant back when Moses, I guess, led the Jewish people out of Egypt, the Exodus. And what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about how the Old Testament God had the covenant with the Jewish people and what that meant, and kind of how that God took care of the people, and when they misbehaved, what happened, you know, and what the Ten Commandments really were for.
Right. Well, the idea was from the time essentially of Abraham that that God designated the Jewish people his chosen people.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave certain specific commandments, circumcision being one of them, that would identify them, and they were supposed to be not intermarrying with other people, and they were supposed to be keeping the culture alive of the worship of, let's say, the one God of Israel. And he was a very fierce God, and a very, you know, meticulously stylized God, in the sense that he demanded certain ritual actions. There were, you know, laws of food and laws of healing and laws of sexuality and laws of inheritance and daily conduct, marriage, and many other things that the Jews were supposed to uphold. And this went on for quite some time before the Ten Commandments. But in any case, you know, then the Jews were enslaved by the Egyptians, and Moses indeed did free them, and they were miraculously taken, you know, away from the Egyptians. The Red Sea parted, and able to wander in the desert. And then when they got to Mount Sinai, which was one of the places I visited, Moses ascended the mountain and received these two tablets that were inscribed directly by the hand of God with these Ten Commandments. And mm-hmm. they were laws, you know, codified laws of social and religious behavior. And when Moses received them, he was actually up in the mountain for about 40 days. Mm-hmm. And the people despaired of his absence, and they began to say, he must be dead, he's not around anymore, and mm-hmm. Why have we left Egypt and we're here out in the desert, and it's like, really, you know, it's not a pleasant place to be, and you know, we were happier in Egypt, even though we were slaves, we had food and a place to sleep, and here we're in the desert, and we were receiving this weird manna from heaven, you know, this mm-hmm. kind of bread that was miraculously provided directly by God, and they got a little sick of it, and they were whining, and the next thing they know, they started rebelling and forcing Moses's brother Aaron to make a golden calf. They donated all their gold and they mm-hmm. melted it down and they fashioned a golden calf, and they began, which was very much like the symbols that the Egyptians worshipped. And they were apparently dancing naked and going wild and all this stuff. And meanwhile, Moses, you know, after his 40 days up on the mountain in communication mm-hmm. with the Lord and fasting and the rest of it, you know, comes down shining with the Ten Commandments in his hands. And he looked at these people and he just got enraged. And he threw the tablets down. And, you know, a lot of people died.
Right.
And then, you know, he went back and got them, got a second pair of tablets and mm-hmm. and brought them back to the people, and everybody recanted. Well, as I say, a lot of those who had given in to the temptation were killed, but a lot of the other ones realized that, you know, this whole thing was really wrong, and worked with Moses and worked with the law of the God of Israel. It's kind of a funny concept because it gives them gives the Jews a great deal of responsibility
mm-hmm.
and a certain form of uniqueness, and at the same time, you know, there are a lot of restrictions placed on them as part of this chosen people concept. And you know, who really knows what all that stuff means? I do know that, you know, Jesus was the one who took it outside of the Jews specifically and taught, you know, his new law to the Greeks and the surrounding people in the Roman Empire and elsewhere.
I have interviewed other authors on the idea that perhaps the gods of the Old Testament, because they behave so much differently than the God that, you know, Jesus introduced, you know, may have been what we call lesser gods, or, you know, even though they were invisible at times, they could be visible. And in fact, there is some information in the Quran, if I'm not mistaken, that the burning bush may have been a plume of a spacecraft. Have you run across that at any time?
Well, you know, I've seen all kinds of things. I mean, I don't really think in those terms, Susan.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think more symbolically, or you know, I deal more in the realm of symbol and archetype. And
right,
you know, to me, when I look at the Bible and I read the words of Jesus, he is walking around quoting the Old Testament constantly, and he is also living and embodying the expectations of the Old Testament as to who, you know, this Messiah or teacher would be, the coming one. And Jesus fit all of those conditions. So for me, Jesus was a reformer. By the time the Bible ends, the Old Testament ends, it's really depressing, you know. The Jewish Bible has a load of prophets followed by this kind of depressing story of Chronicles, at the end of which the Jews are held captive by the Babylonians. The Protestant ordering of the text, the prophets come at the end, and they are so depressing that reading them, you know, in today's society, they would be, you know, locked in mental hospitals and given massive doses of antidepressants, you know. As a physician, you can certainly identify some of, you know, the tendencies of mental illness there. But the Jews were a depressed lot. And then along comes Jesus with this breath of fresh air, but he's really hearkening back to the older concept of God as embodied in, you know, the first 31 verses of Genesis are absolutely beautiful. I challenge anyone to come up with a higher conception of divinity than the original creation story of the first 31 verses. But then what happens is we're introduced to the God of the garden, and the Bible makes it the Bible does not make a distinction between the God of the garden and the original, you know, what Thomas Jefferson referred to as our creator. And wonder about this God of the garden. You know,
he doesn't seem to be behaving quite like, you know.
Right. He's jealous. He's angry. Mm-hmm. He demands.
Yeah, jealous God, yeah.
Yeah. And that concept, the Gnostics identified that as the demiurge and, you know, the lesser deity. And, you know, it's hard to say because, again, you know, these concepts are so far beyond us. I mean, we certainly don't know what God is. And I think, you know, if you could say God is anything, it is that which is unknown or something like that. You know, it's like it's the mystery, it's the miracle, it's the divine, and it's something that we can't, you know, we can't understand. You know, scientists are working in laboratories and coming very close to, you know, creating life, let's say, or creating the conditions in which matter can manifest itself, you know, as life. But that's only because the life is there to begin with. In other words, God is that which created that which the scientists are messing around with. I mean, I love the fact that they're doing it. I'm hardly anti-science, but I believe if I were a scientist, I would be even more spiritual or religious than I am as a you know, person who doesn't understand science, because as a layman, because you know, the miracle and the mystery of life only deepens the more that you know about it.
Yeah, I've looked at some evidence recently that life may actually be something that Star Trek portrayed on one of the shows. In terms of a vibration, that when a planet's ready, it's seeded with a certain vibration, and then life springs up. You know, it's like it's a vibration that life on Earth is similar to life in other places because of a similar vibration.
And, well, I would agree with that, but that vibration that you know, that which vibrates is what I would call God. You know,
right. And then the evidence from that came from sterilizing sand. I mean, the scientific evidence, sterilizing sand, and then seeing life arise in sterilized sand.
Wow.
And all of those. Well, David Wilcox does a pretty good presentation of all of that data. And then comes into this concept that we are currently in the very close, if not in it right now, of an energy coming in from the galactic core that actually causes a great spike in speciation. In fact, every 29,000 years, this spike in speciation occurs. And so that would be evidence that life might be vibrational in terms of this, you know, when the alignment's right, in other words, when the Earth, Sun, and galactic core line up every 29,000 years, then what happens is that life comes to life, you know, more species come out, and perhaps species, you know, develop very quickly. It's not the slow process that Darwin might have presented.
Right. So, certainly. And you know, Darwin presupposes, you know, I believe there's an intelligence behind this whole process that I'm not quite sure Darwin understood, but, you know, be that as it may. The idea that life is vibration is what makes, you know, the sound of Om, for example, so interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole concept of, you know, sacred sound and sacred vibration and the sacred word. I could not agree with you more.
One question I have, you were talking about, Jesus referring back to things mentioned in the Old Testament and then, you know, kind of fulfilling the prophecy that he was coming along. And well, he's, you know, being very, I guess, he had other traditions, of course. He was, you know, he had been into Egypt and India and Ireland, but and he was trained in esoteric traditions before he did his following in Jerusalem. But I think that the thing that really confused me was, and I was reading in your book, and of course I've read in the Bible before, why did the Jews turn against Jesus like they did? It was obvious that Pilate would have forgiven him,
right.
Except that the Jews were angry. I'm confused by that. What was so threatening to the Jews that they demanded that he be put to death?
Well, the idea was that, you know, I think Judaism had stratified and become very rigid and, as I said earlier, very depressed. There was a sense, like, one of the stories that interests me the most is when Jesus was healing on the Sabbath, and, you know, the rabbis were kind of, you know, and the rabbis represented the power structure. They were like the mullahs of today in places like
He was working
Iran
on the Sabbath, and that was forbidden.
right. So, you know, Jesus kind of looks at these, you know, the kind of the, you know, archetypal, again, the bearded cleric, you know, running around today mostly in the Mideast, but, you know, saying stuff like, well, you can't heal on the Sabbath because, you know, God says on the Sabbath you rest and you can't do any work. And Jesus looked at him and said, what the hell are you talking about? You know, this, you're talking about mankind. You know, you're talking about healing. You're talking about the most precious gift that God has given to us. And I can
it's
help
not work.
People become. Yeah, and that's not
really.
Work. That's right. That's sacred duty. And what better day to do it than the Sabbath? So he was a religious radical. You know, he was a reformer. He was a spiritual force who came in to remind the Jews that they were missing the spirit of the law by adhering to, you know, what the rabbis or the power structure was calling the letter of the law, and that they were just missing the boat. Well, some of them embraced the teachings of Jesus quite readily, so you can't say that the Jews rejected Jesus, but you can say that the power structure felt threatened by Jesus and rejected his teaching because it kind of bypassed their authority, and it helped to establish, when Jesus said at a certain point, that which I do, you can do greater things, he was almost pointing the way to, you know, a kind of a Gnosticism, a sense that God indwells every man and woman, and that somehow if we can simply touch the divine essence within our own nature, we can become as sons and daughters of God, just as Jesus claimed to be the Son of God. So these were concepts that were very threatening to a rigid class structure based on, you know, it's like when he overthrew the money changers. There was a paid clerical class that survived off of ancient biblical laws that demanded that a certain amount of money and food and offerings be given to the priesthood, and you know, all of a sudden this usurper comes along and says, no, you don't need to do that to be holy, just believe in the Father. And these guys are just going, oh, we got to get rid of this guy.
Yeah. Well, switching gears again, let's go back to Moses and the Jewish people wandering for 40 years in the desert, and talk a little bit about the Ark. Of course, the Ark was built to put the commandments in. They were stone tablets. They were put in there, and there was something that seemed to me that might be more to the Ark than just a holder of the tablets. However, the instructions given by God to do certain things that then brought down the walls of Jericho, for example. What do you make of that?
Well, I agree with you. I mean, it was a powerful engine, and you know, like an energetic construction that radiated energy. You know, it's funny. It's like the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
No kidding.
That imagery, you know, is really quite telling, I think. But yes, Joshua circled the walls of Jericho, which were supposedly in the ancient world, you know, some of the strongest and most best structures of the ancient world, and he circled for 7 days, and the walls came down when he made the shout or mm-hmm. released that vibration. But he circled with the Ark, and at one point King David was carrying the Ark to Jerusalem to put it at least on the Temple Mount there, and mm-hmm. In the city that he had identified as the eternal capital of Israel. And
right.
He, you know, he started to move the Ark on a cart of oxen that was to transport. It was a specially built cart, and it was very reverent and beautiful and all of
mm-hmm.
that stuff, except that the laws of Moses stated that only the priest class was able to move the Ark, and it was only to be transported on the shoulders of the priest class, that it was not
right.
to be put into an ox-drawn cart. So
right.
David started moving the cart, and there was a big procession and music and dancing and all this holy reverent mm-hmm. stuff, and all of a sudden the ox cart started to tip, and one
mm-hmm.
of the soldiers reached out to protect the Ark, and the minute that his hand touched the side of the Ark, he died instantly, because
right.
he was not of the priest class, and it was not legitimate for him to touch the Ark, and it was a real engine of spiritual power.
Right. I think that's what I want. That's what I want the listeners to understand. That I mean, the Ark was really something very different. And energetic, maybe a, you know, who knows, an energetic keyhole to somewhere else.
Well, it was the most important talismanic treasure of the Jews. It was like you call it a keyhole, or it could be an energy source, or the word that you used earlier, vortex. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was an absolute engine of spiritual power.
Right, and that's why it's so interesting to think that the Ark may be very much associated with the Ascension.
Uh-huh.
You see? Because it's been, you know, it's funny. It's like they don't know where it is. I mean, for sure. You know, there's theories. People claim they have it. Countries claim they have it. Ethiopia claims it's there. But it's still missing. Officially.
Right. Right.
Which is very, very, very interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And So if it ever reappears, we need to pay attention, I think.
Indeed we do.
Indeed we do.
You know, if it ever reappears, I hate to say this, but I think we're going to be doing animal sacrifices on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, so let's be careful.
Yeah. Well, so David, of course, wasn't allowed to build the temple. And you want to explain why that is, that Solomon ended up building it, his son?
Well, David very much wanted to build a temple. He had built a palace for himself, and he started to get, you know, very concerned that he, as the king of the Jewish people, was living in a palace, and the ark was sitting in the tabernacle, where it had been, you know, for some 400 years since it had come through the desert, the 40 years of the wandering and the rest of it. And, you know, he began to desire to build a temple for it. And he spoke to his spiritual advisor, a prophet named Nathan, and Nathan said, sure, go right ahead. And David, you know, was very excited. But then Nathan had communication with God and was told that David had shed too much blood in the military campaigns that he had been forced to conduct, and that the task of building the temple would go to his son, who would be a man of peace. And, you know,
that's
it was
very interesting.
Yeah. What interests me is that the only reason Solomon could afford to be a man of peace was because of the conquest of his father, the man of war, David. The other thing that interests me is that David is the one who identified the Temple Mount in Jerusalem as the true home of the temple. And that is fascinating because
that is.
In the story of the Bible, in the book of Deuteronomy and you know, the five books of Moses, they talk about the central location of Jewish prayer and the Jewish nation, but they never say where it is, and they didn't know where it was supposed to be, but Moses gave very specific laws, like when the place is chosen, this is what will happen there, and you will gather there, and you will bring sacrifices there. And, you know, he even changes the laws of sacrifice from Numbers and Leviticus to Deuteronomy, where he says, however, once, you know, in Numbers and Leviticus, people are supposed to sacrifice things a certain way, and they're supposed to bring their offerings in the local community temples a certain way. But then he says in Deuteronomy that there will be a central location, and then none of these other laws apply. And then this is how things will change. But again, he still doesn't tell us where that is. And it wasn't until David's time, when David conquered Jerusalem, that he actually is, you know, as poor David. I mean, he was like this wonderful guy. In fact, he is my central hero of the Bible. But, you know, he made a lot of mistakes. I guess maybe I identify with his mistakes. But, you know, he just he decided to conduct a census. And it's funny because throughout the Bible, there are a couple of censuses mentioned in like the book of Numbers and things like this, but in those cases it was God who gave the order to make a census and make a count of the Jewish people. In David's case, the Bible sort of implies that David just came up with this idea, and he had a general who said to him, no, don't do it, it's really a bad idea, it seems to imply a lack of faith or something in God. And David said, no, I'm the king, you just go ahead and count the people. And then 8 months later or something, the census was complete, and, you know, David realized that he really made a mistake by this kind of arrogant assuming that he had the power to number the Jewish people. on his own authority. And an angel came and gave him three choices as to, you know, what punishment, you know, Israel would endure because of his mistake. And he chose what he considered to be the least of the punishments, and it was a plague, and the plague kind of went through the whole land until it came to the Temple Mount. And then David prayed really hard that God would stop the plague, because mm-hmm. it wasn't the fault of the people. It was his own fault. And mm-hmm. And the angel of death stopped at the Temple Mount, and David was given to understand that the Temple Mount was to be the central home of worship of the Jewish nation. And that, so he was actually given the plans for the temple as well, right, in dreams. And he wrote down the dimensions and the design of the temple for Solomon. And the other thing that he did, which was key to the temple, was David was the one who built the store of supplies for the construction of the temple. He had the gold and you know, he did all kinds of building of resources toward the eventual construction of the temple. And, you know, and then he aged and died, and Solomon took over and built this temple that his father had envisioned.
And in fact, you said again that the first temple stood how long?
About 400 years. It stood from Solomon. It supposedly took 7 years to build, and it was completed in 957 BC, according to, you know, the ancient Old Testament dating that scholars have done, and they say it basically went from 957 to 585. And then it was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians.
Now, you know, it isn't like people might think, though. It wasn't a place where people went to be around the Ark of the Covenant. You want to explain a little bit about what was inside the temple and how often the high priest approached the Ark?
Right. No, that's great that you say that, Susan, that you asked that, because that's one of the really key parts about this drama, which I hope we can talk about. What happened was, well, let me go back again, if I could, to the tabernacle when this all started with Moses. Moses was in constant contact with God from the time of the burning bush and even before the burning bush. You know, beginning with the burning bush, Moses entered contact with God, and you know, he was very reluctant. He's going through all this stuff of, like, you know, do things this way, and he would say, no, I don't want to do it that way. Could you please let me off the hook? And God kept saying, no, this is... There was a lot of conversation going on there. And Moses would also frequently, throughout the book of Exodus, frequently find himself in communion with the Lord. But what happened was that a set of rules were established about the conduct of the ark and the entrance to the Holy of Holies and the tabernacle and the rest of it, and it all boiled down to only one day a year, on the day of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, was the high priest alone of all the Jewish people allowed to enter into the Holy of Holies and communion with God. And that communion, that entrance of the Holy of Holies and into the Holy of Holies and the sacrifice and the you know, offering of blood and the offering of the burnt offerings would atone for the sins of the Jewish people, the entire nation, the community, and would guarantee them another year of you know, peace and life, let's say, and that was the only the high priest, you know, and only once a year, one day a year. Now, what's interesting about the Temple of Solomon, as you mentioned, is that the same law was in effect at that time, and even Solomon could not enter the Holy of Holies.
That's right. That's what I want people to understand. It was, I mean, not everybody can approach an energy field like the Ark and live. So,
right.
You know, that's that's something that that I think people, you know, people need to understand that this was very different than, say, you know, an average thing that people worshipped. It wasn't like that.
Right. Now, where I think it gets interesting, and this, you know, is something I hope that you'll bear with me for a second on this, is that I think of this as, you know, the defining of the kind of exclusivity of the availability of Gnosis at this time. In other words, this I find this part disturbing. I'm much more of the mind that Moses and Jesus and Adam and Eve are far better examples for us, people like you and me, because if we're willing to do the work and we're willing to align ourselves with the divine energy and do the spiritual practices and lead the kinds of life that need to be led in order to be in touch with and in union with the divine force, that we needn't be designated high priest or high priestess of Israel, you know, that we could, you know, Dr. Kolb and me, you know, James Wasserman, could both be doing it simultaneously as long as we're willing to do the work that's required. And I think that the idea that there was one ritualized person, I personally find disturbing. I like the idea that this is available to anyone who is willing to work for it. And I think that that's what Jesus meant, again, when he said, that which I do, you will do greater works.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think it's a human condition. We each have a vibrational rate, and through our thoughts and our actions, and especially our intents, we either raise that vibrational level or lower it. And only the high priest with very high vibrational diet because of, you know, spiritual practices, diet, you know, prayer, whatever, genetics, who knows, probably genetics, then we're able to tolerate the energies that the Ark had around them. Yeah.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I just think, you know, it's available to more than one person at one time. And that's, you know, my only disagreement with the Bible where it talks about that, because I think that, you know, yeah, you and I could both do it if we were willing to go through the strict regimen of spiritual development that's required to raise our vibrational rate to tolerate, you know, something of the nature of the Ark of the Covenant, that, yes, we could do that.
There's additional chapters in the book on the Knights Templar, which, of course, are very important in history. And then on to the Freemasons and some of the secret societies that use very heavily the building of the Temple of Solomon as in initiations. Unfortunately, we won't have time to cover that, but I do want to mention that for our listeners. This is an absolutely beautiful book. It's very large. It's got wonderful pictures in it. Jim's done a great job of really bringing to life this part of history, which I think we probably haven't really heard too much of since, you know, maybe since Bible school or church. But it's certainly a great book, and I appreciate you doing it. Would you like to give some contact information for our listeners?
Well, certainly, and I thank you so much for your kind words. I also want to mention that I talked a little bit about my own experience with this as well at the very, very end of the book.
Right, and you do.
To me, that part of it, you know, what does this really mean? And you know, to a modern person. And I think that that's something which our listeners might enjoy reading as well, because it's a narrative of a modern person making some contact with these ancient archetypes and sacred places. And I have a website called jameswassermanbooks.com, and all my books are on there, and you can click on there and either order from Amazon at very nice discounted prices, or order directly from me for signed copies, which I also have copies of my book. So, you know, I welcome people to do that. And really, thank you for the time that we've spent today. This has been a really fun interview for me.
Well, thank you. And I do want to mention that currently on the Dome of the Rock is another structure. Would you like to just briefly mention that one?
Well, sure. There's the Dome of the Rock is the Muslim shrine, which encloses the foundation stone of the world, the Rock of Ages. And that, you know, is part of Muslim tradition as the place where Muhammad took his night journey. And in fact, there's the other building on the Temple Mount is currently today is called the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which means the further journey. And that's how the Quran describes Muhammad's night journey as the further journey. And the further the farther place, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, curiously enough, was what the Knights Templar, that was their headquarters, and they actually believed that that was the Temple of Solomon, and they called themselves the Knights of the Temple of Solomon, and they were actually mistaken in their their understanding of what the building was that they were in. Probably that building very likely may have been the palace of David or Solomon's palace or one of the royal palaces, and the temple itself, the Temple of Solomon itself, probably stood either on the site of the Dome of the Rock today or a little bit north of it. Some people feel that it's a little north of the current location of the Dome of the Rock, but you know, nobody really knows. And right now, most religious Jews are told not to go on to the Temple Mount because they could very likely stand on the site of the Holy of Holies, and that's forbidden. So the most religious Jews won't even
forbidden.
Go up
You're
there.
Right.
Yeah,
and then of course we have the prophecy in Revelations that we can look forward to the rebuilding of the temple. Do you think that that's another temple than what's on the rock right now?
Oh, I think what's on the rock now, I mean, I don't personally feel that belongs there, but that's my own personal opinion. And I'm not.
Well, in any case, it's a pivotal point on the planet for the history of forever, as far back as history goes, and then as far forward as history grows in Revelations, it certainly binds us all together, whatever religion we are, Jewish, Christian, or Muslim. And it's just great that you wrote the book to put it in such a great story for people. But thank you very much for joining us. It was a great interview.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Susan, and I wish you well. And I'm going to like your Facebook page. I see that you have one, and I looked at it today, and I thought, well, maybe I should wait till after the interview to say
right.
I like it, and indeed, today I will.
Well, thanks. Well, next week we have Dr. Bradley Nelson, who is the author of The Body Code, and then Dr. Richard Presser is joining us again for the 2012 countdown on 922. And in September, the Noetic Science Meeting here will be Biophysics in Your Body by Dr. Brad Gould, which is 7:30 at the Dunwoody office. And Dr. Mike is presenting a free lecture, You Can Prevent Dementia, which is on the 25th at 7 p.m. at the Dunwoody office as well. Thank you very much for joining us on Temple of Health Radio Show, and we'll see you next week.